Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everyone, what is up? Welcome back to another episode of Killer Instinct, you guys. Thank you so much for joining me here today. If you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah, and I'm your host of Killer Instinct. Before we get started, make sure you go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way you never miss an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday, as well as upload the video version onto YouTube on Wednesdays as well. And you are not going to want to miss it. Well, you guys, we have made it to the very last episode of March, which means this is the last of these celebrity cases. If you've been keeping up over the past couple months, we have dedicated each month to a different true crime category. January was unsolved cases, February was killer couples, and March we did celebrity cases. It has been a wild ride with these cases, and I've loved hearing what you guys have to say about them. So let me know in the comments below what you think the category for April's cases are going to be. I'm very interested to see what you guys guess and what you would like to see in the future. Now, there was no way I could end the celebrity cases month without touching on the case of Jill Dando. The case of Jill Dando is one that captivated the entire nation when she was murdered in April 1999. Now, this technically is still an unsolved case with a lot of theories out there, and I'm very interested to see what you guys have to say about this case and what your theories are. So with that being said, let's jump right on into it today. Jill Dando was born on November 9th, 1961 in Somerset, England, to her parents, Jack and Winifred. She grew up with an older brother named Nigel, and growing up, she attended the local World Comprehensive School while her father worked as an electrical engineer and her mother was a hairdresser. Growing up, her family was very close and very supportive of one another. Every Sunday, they had a tradition of going on picnics together, and after graduating from high school, Jill went on to attend Cardiff Metropolitan University, where she studied journalism. From a very, very young age, Jill had always had a passion for journalism. She loved storytelling. She was very interested in the news. She just had the passion from the very beginning. Now, along with this passion for journalism, Jill also had many other interests. She was very invested in philanthropy and getting involved with her community whenever she could. She also enjoyed cooking. She was a very big advocate for eating healthy and having a healthy lifestyle. That was something that was really important to her. Jill also loved traveling. She loved immersing herself into different cultures and learning about different cultures and different people. And overall, Jill's personality was said to be outgoing and bubbly, and she always had this charismatic, captivating, and magnetic personality. Now, from the very beginning, like I said, Jill's passion for journalism started from a very young age, and her family has always said that it was without question. They knew that Jill was going to grow up and be a journalist. It was like it was written in the stars. She had it set from the very, very early age. She was a complete natural at it. Jill's first job was when she was working for a local newspaper called the Weston Mercury. Both her father and her brother had also previously worked there, and it was at the Weston Mercury where she was really able to gain some great experience, and she also really was able to hone in on her reporting skills. Jill ended up working for Weston Mercury for 5 years before she got offered a job at BBC, which stands for British Broadcasting Corporation. She got a job as a newsreader, and by 1988, Jill made her way to presenting on national television in London with the BBC programs Breakfast Time, Breakfast News, and BBC's 1 o'clock and 6 o'clock news. Now, obviously, this was a very exciting time for Jill because this is really all she ever wanted out of life. This was her biggest dream, all from when she was a very young girl. She had always wanted to be a journalist, and now those dreams were coming true. In 1995, Jill began presenting the BBC BBC television program called Crime Watch. Now, Crime Watch is still an active program today, but at the time that Jill was involved in it, she was reporting on unsolved crimes, hoping to gain exposure and ultimately solve these cases. It was something that she was really passionate about. She really connected to people in that way, and she wanted to help, and that's exactly what she was doing here. Now, Jill was really a perfect fit for this role because of her compassion. Like I said, she really wanted to help people, and overall, she was a very well-liked and well-trusted reporter. People liked watching her, people enjoyed listening to her, and they trusted what she was saying. Now, over time, Jill really became a staple for BBC as a news reporter and was very, very popular in the public. The public loved her warm and inviting personality, and some even said that she was in second place as far as public affection went, and the only person ahead of her for that title at the time was Princess Diana. So just to kind of give you an overview and to give you an understanding of the type of celebrity that Jill had, she was widely respected and had a great mix of professionalism and empathy as well. She also appeared genuinely interested in every story that she was covering and had a very girl next door type of approach to her, which made her very relatable to most people. So now that you have a little bit of the backstory, let's jump to April 26th, 1999. Now, at this day, at approximately 11:47 a.m., the Kensington police received a phone call regarding a shooting in Fulham. Now, Fulham is a low-crime, nice area that was not used to seeing any sort of crime, let alone a shooting. Now, the lead investigator of this case at the time was a man named Hamish Campbell, and he was told about the shooting and told to go over to the crime scene. Now, on his way over to the crime scene, Hamish received a phone call from his superior telling him that the victim of this shooting was Jill Dando. When Campbell arrived to the scene, he watched as Jill was rushed off to the hospital in an ambulance. However, she was pronounced dead upon arrival at 1:03 p.m. Now, when detectives arrived, they were told that no one had seen the murder itself. However, there were two witnesses who saw a man leaving the crime scene. The witnesses described this man as a white man with dark hair, with a thicker build, wearing a dark coat. Now, Jill's neighbor was a man named Richard, and he claimed that around the time of the shooting, he heard Jill scream, but Richard claimed when he heard this scream, he thought it was a happy scream or that someone had surprised Jill. He had no idea what was really going on. But still, Richard said that after he heard the scream, he looked out of his window to see what was happening, and that is when he said that he also saw a man walking away from Jill's house. He confirmed that this was a white male around the age of 40, standing at about 6 feet tall. Now, Campbell claimed that when he arrived onto the scene, the crime scene was already heavily contaminated when he got there because there had been so many first responders who rushed in trying to resuscitate Jill, and in doing that, it kind of contaminated the crime scene as it was. But regardless, the detectives still grabbed everything that they could possibly find that could be potential evidence. They picked up different pieces of gravel, fingerprints that were on the gate, Jill's belongings, all of it. Now, at the crime scene, they also discovered a bullet casing on the ground. Now, according to the medical examiner, they claimed that Jill had been killed by a single gunshot wound to the left side of her head from a 9mm caliber gun. Forensics said that the gun was pressed against her head at the time that she was shot. Now, while some detectives were packing up the crime scene, other investigators and other police were sent out in the surrounding areas to search for anything that could be related to Jill's murder. Officers were meticulously searching the area from top to bottom. They were really taking apart everything. They were going through people's trash cans. They were searching in flower beds. They were looking under cars to see if they could find anything that linked back to Jill's murder. The big thing that they were looking here and the main thing that they were looking here was that murder weapon. But unfortunately, after hours and hours of searching, that murder weapon was never, ever found. Now, journalists say that the murder of Jill Dando was the biggest story that they had reported at the time, other than the death of Princess Diana. Everyone was really shaken up by Jill's murder, and the media was constantly covering what happened. The murder really frightened a lot of people, especially women journalists who began fearing for their lives based off of the unknown of Jill's murder. No one knew what the motive was here. No one knew why Jill was killed. Jill really did feel like one of them. All of the other journalists, the women journalists especially, saw themselves in Jill. Many of them looked up to Jill, and so to see something like this happen to her was simply unfathomable. At the day of Jill's funeral, there were thousands of people, fans of Jill, all lined up outside of the church waiting and watching as her coffin drove by. Now, initially, it seemed like everyone had a theory about what happened to Jill, but all of the theories were not the same. Some people thought that Jill could have made someone mad while she was reporting on Crime Watch. Maybe she was reporting on a specific case that someone didn't want her to talk about, and in doing so, it cost her her life. Now, something else that police wanted to look into was all the male higher-ups at BBC and see if they had any connection into Jill's death. And they also wanted to look into her personal life, more specifically, her love life. We see this time and time again with cases. We've talked about it time and time again. The first people that are looked at always in a murder investigation, typically, or really any missing persons, kidnapping investigation, is always the significant other. Now, as far as Jill's love life goes, she had been in a relationship with a BBC executive named Bob Wheaton from 1989 to 1996. And then in 1997, she had gotten engaged to a man named Alan Farthing. Now, Alan was a gynecologist at the time who would later go on to actually be Queen Elizabeth's personal doctor. And the two were set up on a blind date by a mutual friend and got engaged on January 31st, 1999, and their wedding was set to take place on September 25th, sadly just a few months after Jill's murder. So with that all being said, it really should be no surprise when I tell you that one of the first people that police wanted to speak to in regards to Jill's murder was Alan Farthing. When doing so, police learned that at the time that him and Jill met, Alan was separated from his wife, and then once the divorce was finalized, him and Jill went public with their relationship. Now, Alan was able to provide an alibi to police, but also told them something a little interesting. Alan explained that not long before Jill's murder, Jill had actually given Bob Wheaton, the BBC executive that she had a relationship with, a good sum of money. According to Alan, he claimed that Jill gave Bob about £35,000, which is about equivalent to $44,000 in US dollars. Now, with this new information, it really made police sit back and think. They wondered why Jill would be so willing to give a good portion of money to her ex-boyfriend, Bob. Now, after the funeral, police went to visit Bob at his home to ask him about the money. Now, when looking at Bob, police definitely could see a potential motive here. They thought that maybe Bob didn't have the money to pay Jill back, or maybe he never wanted to pay her back, which would have been potential motive to kill her. Now, Bob explained that the money that Jill gave him was simply to help him purchase his next home, and that Jill was just a very generous person and was generous to everyone, and that the two ended their relationship on really good terms and they were able to remain friends. So this was just a matter of Jill doing something nice for Bob. This wasn't, you know, a breakup that ended in animosity or anger and that this was just some outlandish out-of-pocket thing. He just explained that Jill was a very generous person. They had a conversation about Bob purchasing his next home and Jill offered to give the money to him. Now, while police didn't fully understand this explanation as this was not the most normal thing to be doing, they looked deeper into Bob and his alibi and were ultimately able to confirm that he was not a suspect in Jill's murder and that he had no connection to it whatsoever. Now, when police looked more into Jill's personal life, they learned that even though she had her townhome in Fulham, she typically stayed at her fiance Alan's home in West London. So because of this, she really was very rarely ever at her own townhome in Fulham. This made police think that whoever did this to Jill had to have known that she was going to be at her house that day, or had to have been following her to see that she went home. So because of this, police then tried to go back and retrace Jill's steps to really figure out what happened the morning leading up to Jill's death. When doing this, they learned that the morning started out like any other one. Jill had stayed at Alan's house the night prior and left his home at approximately 10:05 a.m., and she stopped at a gas station along her way into Hammersmith Town Center, where she is seen walking around into 2 to 3 different shops looking to buy fax paper. Afterwards, she returned to her car and drove down Fulham Road to her house on Gowan Avenue. She parked outside her home at 11:31 and then walked up the walkway leading to her front door, where she was then confronted and killed at her doorstep. Now, police scoured all of the CCTV footage that they could of Jill that morning, retracing her steps, seeing all the different stores that she went into that morning, and never once in any of this footage did it appear that Jill was being followed by anyone. So because of this, police wondered if maybe Jill was communicating with someone that day who knew what she was doing, who knew where she was going, if she was keeping anyone up to date about her whereabouts that could have potentially followed her back to her home. Now, when they did this, they saw that Jill, in fact, was in communication with someone that day, keeping them updated on her whereabouts, and that person was her agent, John Roseman. Now, John had been described as really being a straight shooter. He's described as being someone who wears his emotions on his sleeve. You would know when he's upset or angry at something. Other journalists in the industry who knew John recalled a time where John took a baseball bat to a few different objects after he had gotten angry on a particular occasion. Now, when police went to speak with John, he explained that the two of them were in communication that morning because Jill was telling him that she was going to go back to her home to pick up some faxes that she needed to give to John, and that she was going to be doing this and then heading back into work. So that was the explanation from John as to why they were in communication that morning. But something that was a red flag to police was while they were inside of John's home, police spotted a book that John had been writing. According to John, he always wanted to be a writer, so he had written this novel, and the premise of this book, it was a story about an agent whose clients were being murdered under mysterious circumstances, and one of these clients in this book was shot. Now, even though this is eerily bizarre, this is an eerily bizarre coincidence, John claims that this was just a book that he was writing. Obviously, it had no connection to Jill's murder, and police definitely had their questions about it. They even asked John what was the timeline between the first murder in the book and the second murder of the book, thinking it was possible that maybe this killer was on a spree and following John's timeline in this novel. Now, after doing some more digging on John, and after vetting him out a little bit more, they were finally able to remove John as a potential suspect for several reasons. One of the biggest ones was that not only did John really not have a motive, but if anything, Jill's death really was a financial burden on him, which is a terrible way to view it and a terrible way to think about it. But if anything, Jill's death was a financial toll on John. So that was something that police had definitely took into account. Along with that, he did have a solid alibi, so there really was no reason for John to be tied to Jill's murder, and he was also excluded as being a potential suspect. So now the police are starting to wonder, did Jill Dando have a stalker? Jill was in the public eye and someone who had a lot of eyes on her, and according to the people closest to Jill, there were several stalkers that Jill had over the course of her career. Now, police were not able to track down many of these stalkers. However, the ones that they were able to see through fan mail and different messages that Jill would receive, police determined that these stalkers were more so sexualizing Jill than anything else. It wasn't necessarily violent, and it wasn't multiple times. It was typically one and they wouldn't hear from them again, or there would be a couple. But even though none of those messages were acceptable whatsoever, police just didn't believe that this was was the work of a stalker. It just wasn't something that was as persistent. Jill never really talked about one specific stalker, and so police really moved on from that theory. Now, there is a big theory that gets talked about in this case that I want to touch on, and that was that the day after Jill was murdered, BBC Newsroom received a phone call from a Serbian man claiming to be the person who killed Jill. Now, the reason that this was relevant was because Jill had been reporting on the Yugoslav wars that were happening during this time, and during the war, NATO had bombed the media room in Serbia, killing multiple journalists. So now you have a Serbian man claiming that they killed Jill out of retaliation for the NATO bombing and for the coverage that Jill was giving. However, it turns out that the man who made these phone calls, they were not credible, and the calls were deemed to be hoaxes. So police really didn't look into that theory very much after that. Now, at this point, police really wanted to look out into the public. They wanted to reach the public to see if anyone could help them solve this case. And to do so, they ended up creating an entire Crime Watch episode based off of Jill's murder. Now, this was definitely a surreal moment to many to have an episode on the show based off of the old host. The person who hosted the show now has an entire episode about them. Now, in the episode, there was a lot of emphasis on a blue Range Rover that was seen during the time of the murder in Fulham. Now, with this blue Range Rover, there was a traffic warden who, at the time of the shooting, was in the process of writing a ticket to this blue Range Rover that was parked in a zone that it wasn't supposed to be parked in. But right as this warden is writing the ticket, there is a person that comes by and gets into the car and drives away, and the warden really didn't think much of it and continued on with their day. Now, this blue Range Rover was then later seen speeding across the Putney Bridge and running several different red lights, so police really emphasized this specific blue Range Rover. They wanted to know who drove this Range Rover, who was responsible for it, if this person had any connection to Jill's murder, because it definitely seemed like whoever was driving this car was trying to get away as fast as they could. But finding a blue Range Rover in the UK has been compared to trying to find a needle in a haystack. There was so many of them, and police did receive a lot of tips of people who were calling about blue Range Rovers, but again, there was no license plate. Police had a really hard time narrowing down this specific blue Range Rover. It was nearly impossible to do. Now, after the Crime Watch episode aired, there were countless tips that got called in to police, but there was one that stood out more than the others. Now, on this phone call, the person who made the call said that he knew who killed Jill Dando and gave the names of some people involved. Now, the man who called identified himself as being Mr. James and said that the people who killed Jill were active criminals from a higher-up drug cartel, and that Jill Dando's murder was a professional hit. So Mr. James ends up meeting in person with Detective Campbell and some other investigators. And just so we're all clear, Mr. James has been used as an alias. So Mr. James meets with Campbell and other investigators, and whatever Mr. James told police, it was enough for the police to decide to look more closely into this criminal network. And police began following this group around, listening in on their conversations, seeing where they were going. But ultimately, police realized that with this group of people, while they were very much criminals, they didn't have anything to do with Jill's death, or they at least couldn't find any link that would connect them to Jill's death. So after this, police now go back to square one. They return back to the original witnesses who claim to see a man running away from Jill's house after the shooting. Now, after speaking with these witnesses, police were able to create an EFIT, which stands for Electronic Facial Identification Technique, and this was a computer method that, based off of witness description, the computer could piece together a digital composite of what a suspect is believed to look like. So now we have AI, but at the time, it was EFIT. Now, police created this e-fit and took the picture to the press conference. They told the public that while they didn't have any actual persons of interest or suspects at that time, they did have this composite picture of what the witnesses claimed that the man looked like. Now, after the e-fit had been released to the public, there was a man named James Shackleton who had called police and actually told them himself that he looked very, very similar to this e-fit sketch. Now, James was a funeral director who police had their eye on for his bizarre behavior. James had been known to previously try to get himself involved in other murder investigations or other criminal investigations. So because of this, police wanted to speak with James. Now, when police went to go do so, and James told police that on the day of Jill's murder, he was walking through a park in Fulham. And while he was walking through this park, he started getting chased by another man, causing him to run out of the park and run to a bus stop in Fulham. Now, this is very important because it made police wonder if James was the guy that witnesses saw running around that day. I do want to note that it's unclear whether or not police were able to track down this man that chased James out of the park that day. We're not really clear about that interaction. I know I just kind of brushed over that, but that's because there's not a lot of information in regards to what that whole scenario was. But police then decided to search James's home. And when they did that, they discovered a coffin in his house. And while that might be weird to some people, James was a funeral director who had been known to build coffins in the past. Now, while he was being investigated by police, James did come forward into the media and said that he was not responsible for Jill's death. He also claimed that he was gay, so he would not be obsessed with Jill or stalking Jill because he had no interest in her. Now, after some time, police realized that while James definitely had his quirks, he was not responsible for Jill's murder. Now, something that I do want to touch on is CCTV footage. There were CCTV cameras on Jill's street and in the surrounding streets of Fulham, and police were a little late to the game when asking for these tapes, because by the time police got around to asking for them, it's unclear when exactly that time frame was, but by the time they went to go ask for these tapes, the tapes had already been erased. So however long it was long enough where these tapes no longer existed. And so this was definitely a missed opportunity. It's unclear why they didn't ask for the tapes in the beginning to begin with, because this definitely seemed like it would answer a lot of questions and it would actually really speed up the process of this investigation and bring justice to whoever did this to Jill. So why the tapes were not asked for in the beginning is a question mark, but it was definitely a missed opportunity on the detective's part. Now, within 6 months, the detectives had spoken to over 4,000 people and had taken over 1,000 statements in this investigation. Now, police who have worked this case since the very beginning have since come forward and said that they regret releasing that e-fit composite sketch for several reasons. They claim that it really derailed their investigation because they claim that the sketch itself is of a very average looking person. There is not a lot of identifying factors. There is nothing that really stands out about the image. So because of that, they had so many people calling in with all of these tips, and it really created more harm than it did good because there was an overwhelming amount of information to go through based off of this e-fit composite sketch. And during this investigation, at least at the very beginning, there were only 16 detectives that were working on this case. And so with that amount of tips that were coming in constantly and the rush of tips that came in, it was hard to navigate through all of that. So they have since come forward and said that they regret releasing the sketch for that reason. Now, I want to take a moment and talk about the gun. I want to talk about the murder weapon because to this day, the gun that killed Jill has never been recovered. Now, initially, police believed that the gun that killed Jill was a 9mm pistol. As I mentioned earlier, there was a brass casing from the bullet that was recovered at the crime scene near Jill's body. Now, when police looked more closely at this casing, they realized that this was not your typical 9mm pistol. The bullet casing had 6 indentations on it around the top part of the rim, and those indentations in the bullet, the crimps that were made on it, it was clear that because of that, because they were different, they had different amounts of pressure on each one, this led police to believe that the crimping crimping was handmade. Now, the police have said after reviewing the crimping that it made them believe that the gun had a certain quote-unquote homemadeness to it. Police then reached out to the public asking for assistance if anyone knew anyone who had a firearm with these particular characteristics. Now, in February of the year 2000, police began receiving several tips from the public in regards to the gun. Now, after police had looked to the public in regards to the different tips involving the gun, in February of the year 2000, police began receiving these tips and also began receiving some tips that were very similar to one another. There were employees of different establishments that were contacting police saying there was a man who had reached out to these different stores. It was the same man who was reaching out to all of these different stores. And according to these employees, this man had visited the store on the day of Jill's death. So he had been in the store. And according to them, he had called back about a month later asking if they could confirm him being there. He would ask these employees what time he visited the store and even ask if they remembered what he was wearing. That way they would be able to positively identify him. Now, these phone calls were made, like I said, within the first month of the murder. However, police did not hear about it until almost a year later. Now, to police, this seemed like a very big red flag because it almost seemed as if someone was trying to create an alibi for themselves on the day of Jill's murder. Now, the man who was making these phone calls, who is this man, you probably are asking? The man who was making these phone calls was a man named Barry Bolsera. That is how he was identifying himself. Barry lived on Crookham Road, which was about a half mile away from where Jill lived. So, who is Barry Bolsera? Well, it took some time for police to track down Barry because that was actually not his real name. That was the name he went by. However, his real name was Barry George. From a very young age, Barry was known to impersonate famous celebrities. He would use their real names. For example, Freddie Mercury's real name is Farouk Bolsara. Freddie Mercury is just the stage name that he uses, but Barry adopted the last name as an alias and told people that his cousin was Freddie Mercury. And when he was in grade school, he would do the same thing. He used the name Paul Gadd, which was the real name for the singer called Gary Glitter. In the 80s, he was also fined for impersonating a police officer. Now, Barry was unemployed and had been previously convicted for attempted rape, as well as indecent assault on a woman. Now, because of this, police were able to get approval to put Barry under 24-hour surveillance, and when doing so, police realized that Barry was very much a loner. He spent a lot of time just wandering around town, walking from place to place, and police also got search warrants to look into Barry's house. And when they did that, they went to Barry's home, knocked several times. There was no answer, so they forced the door open. Now, upon arrival and once police got inside, they realized that Barry's home was an absolute train wreck. It was actually described by a member of law enforcement who said that if you imagined a movie set of someone's messy house, this would almost seem like too much of an exaggeration. It wouldn't seem realistic because it would seem like it was so over the top that it couldn't be real. But he claimed that that was what Barry's house looked like. It was unbelievable. There were piles of trash everywhere. It was infested with bugs and fecal matter, and anything that you could imagine was being festered up in that house. Now, while police were searching the home, they did discover something that they thought could possibly be connected to Jill's murder. While searching the home, they discovered a coat that was very similar to the one that the witness had described the man wearing. Other items that they discovered in the home were a gun holster, as well as undeveloped film and a handwritten list of firearms. Now, police ended up getting this underdeveloped film developed, and when they did, they saw that Barry was taking hundreds and hundreds of pictures of women. Now, these women clearly did not know that they were being photographed. They were just walking around, doing their day-to-day tasks, living their lives, not noticing that Barry was following them and taking pictures of them along the way. Now, there was also a very disturbing photo of what appears to be Gary wearing a gas mask and holding up a handgun. Now, it is believed that the handgun in this photo is very similar to the type of gun that is believed to have killed Jill. Now, because of this, Barry Harry became the prime suspect in Jill's death, and police were able to get a warrant for his arrest in May of the year 2000. Now, when police first interviewed Barry, they were actually surprised that he was willing to talk to them voluntarily. And during this interrogation, Barry insisted that he had never met Jill and also did not know who she was. So while he's saying that he has not even met her, he's also saying that he's never heard of her. Now, based off of Jill's celebrity status, police found this very hard to believe because, again, Jill was the number one journalist at the time and she was everywhere. Everyone knew who Jill was. And so Barry also insisted that he had never bought or had used the type of gun that was used to kill Jill. However, police claimed that they knew that Barry was lying because they went back to that picture of what appears to be Gary in the gas mask holding the gun, because that is the similar or same type of gun used to kill Jill. And when shown this picture, police showed this picture to Barry, but Barry insisted that it is not him in the photo and that it could be anyone, but he also claimed that he didn't know who it was. Now, another piece of evidence that was used against Barry, and really the biggest piece of evidence that was used against Barry, was when police looked inside the coat pocket of the coat that was collected from his home. Remember, as I said, there was a jacket that police took that resembled the jacket that witnesses claimed to have seen the man running away from the crime scene wearing. When police and forensics looked at this coat, they discovered a single particle of gunshot residue in the inside of the coat pocket. Not only that, that singular particle was the same particle that was found at the crime scene of Jill's murder. Now, this piece of evidence really changed the direction of the investigation dramatically. And when asked about this, Barry didn't really have an explanation. He didn't know what to say. He couldn't come up with a reason as to why this would be the case. But regardless, this was sufficient enough evidence for police to go ahead and fully charge Barry with the murder of Jill Dando. Now, right before the trial, Barry had a mental health evaluation, and during this evaluation, he was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, as well as several other personality disorders, including antisocial personality disorder, histrionic, narcissistic, and potentially paranoia. Now, his IQ was also said to be 75, which is significantly lower than the average, which is anywhere around 100. Now, the trial for Barry began in 2001. And the defense in this trial really argued that the police had no actual proof that Barry was responsible for this. They claimed that he was the easy target. It was easy for police to pin this on Barry because he was sort of an odd guy with an obsession for women, but it didn't mean that he had an obsession with Jill, and it also didn't mean that he killed her. Now, they also said that they didn't believe that Barry was capable of pulling off something like this because of his mental state, and they believed that the murder had to have been done by a professional assassin. So that was really the defense's strategy throughout all of this, was claiming and arguing that Barry did not do this, and that this really seemed like the work of a professional hitman. Now, when it came to the cartridge and the crimping of the cartridge, the defense claimed that the crimping was a characteristic used by Serbians, which brings us back to the Serbian connection in this case, and the fact that a possible motive for Jill's murder could have been revenge or retaliation. Now, the same month that Jill was killed in April, there was another journalist who was murdered outside of his home in Belgrade, which is in Serbia, and that was about 11 days before Jill's murder. So this was another example of the possible motive here, that this could be connected to that. Now, when it comes to the prosecution really honed in on this one singular piece of gunshot residue that was found in Barry's jacket. But something else that they brought up in trial was the women that Barry had been hyperfixating on. One of those women was actually Princess Diana. It had been reported on a specific occasion that Barry was seen walking around Kensington Palace with a coil of rope, wearing combat gear, and carrying a 12-inch hunting knife. Now, at the time, he was asked to leave the premises, but police really didn't give it much concern at that time, which is honestly quite shocking to hear, but I digress. But this was something that the prosecution brought into play as well in the trial. And along with that, the prosecution also brought up a witness named Susan, who claimed that she saw Barry near Jill's house at approximately 7:30 a.m. on the morning of the murder. It was also said on the day of the murder that Barry had visited a local advice center and several days later went back to that same center to confirm what time he had been there. Now, really, for the prosecution, the only physical evidence that they had in this case was the particle of gunshot residue. It was the strongest piece of evidence in this case, and everything else was really circumstantial other than that. So after the defense and the prosecution had rested their case, the jury went back for deliberation, and afterwards, they found Barry George guilty of the murder of Jill Dando. So Barry was now sent to prison, but not for long. In 2002, Barry appealed his conviction and tried to dispute the reliability of the forensic evidence of the gunshot residue that was used in his trial. However, the court had dismissed his appeal. Then in 2006, Barry's lawyers tried to appeal again, this time saying that Barry was not mentally fit for trial and that also he was not capable of committing this murder due to his mental state. Now, the defense also brought along a neuropsychiatrist to further strengthen their argument, and this neuropsychiatrist spoke to Barry and claimed that while Barry did have an understanding of what was going on around him, he wasn't fully able to respond to it appropriately. Now, along with that, the neuropsychiatrist claimed that Barry was not calculated enough to commit this crime. Whoever did this was experienced, is what the neuropsychiatrist and the defense were trying to argue. This was clearly someone who knew what they were doing. This was someone who was not messy, was not sloppy. They claimed that Barry was not calculated enough to fully go through with something like this and not leave a trail of evidence behind them. They're claiming that this one particle of gunshot residue is not enough to prove that Barry is responsible for this. And really, to argue this gunshot residue theory, they claimed that the reason for it being there, or one of the reasons for it being there, could be because armed officers were the ones that had arrested Barry and gone through the home and taken the jacket. And it's possible, according to the defense, that the particle of gunshot residue could have gotten into that jacket. Now, does that explain why the gunshot residue would be the same at the crime scene? Not necessarily, but that is what the defense was arguing. Now, in November of 2007, the Court of Appeal looked at this case again, and they concluded that had the jury been given all of this new information that I just presented to you about the neuropsychiatrist and about the gunshot residue theory, had they been given that information, who knows if Barry would have been found guilty. So, because of this, his conviction was thrown out and a retrial was ordered. The retrial happened on June 9th of 2008, and Barry pled not guilty. Now, for the prosecution, their argument was different this time because the judge ruled that the gunshot residue was not to be spoken about in this new trial. So the prosecution, the one piece of evidence that they did have, they couldn't bring this up in the new trial. They couldn't talk about it. It was inadmissible in court. So instead, the prosecution really had to lean on Barry's bizarre behavior and him stalking women. But that was not enough to convict Barry of murder. The defense really leaned into Barry's alibi, claiming that he was at the advice center by 11:50 or noon that day. So it would have been impossible for him to have committed a murder at 11:30 because he would have to commit the murder, go home, change his clothes, and then go to the advice center to be there by around 11:50 approximately. They claimed that Barry's home was in the opposite direction of this advice center, so it would have taken him longer had he gone home, changed his clothes, and then went over. So this second trial was then concluded, and on August 1st, 2008, Barry George was found not guilty of the murder of Jill Dando, and he was set free. Now, as you can imagine, there were a lot of opinions, conflicting opinions, about Barry's not guilty verdict. Many people felt like Barry had just gotten away with murder, while others felt like there wasn't enough evidence to fully convict him. Either way, after his acquittal, there really was no other investigation that happened as far as looking into what happened to Jill. The case really went cold after that, and the question of who killed Jill Dando still remains. Now, again, like I said, there are certain people that believe that Barry did it. The gunshot residue in the pocket matches the gunshot residue found at the crime scene. Closed case, done deal. Barry had to be responsible. But there are other people who wholeheartedly believe that this was a professional hitman. Now, the motive for this hit, still a little unclear. Could it be connected to the Serbian retaliation that was happening? Yes. Could it have been something else? Yes. There have been people that were in jail at the time of Jill's murder, as well as in organized crime networks, who have come forward and confirmed that Jill's death was the result of a professional hit. However, that is the furthest we have on that. Again, a lot of theories in this case, a lot more questions than answers, but the biggest one is who killed Jill Dando. We still don't know, but I'm very interested to hear what you guys have to say about that. So please let me know in the comments below. And with that being said, you guys, that is all for me today. Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Killer Instinct. Again, if you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah and I'm your host of Killer Instinct. Make sure you go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way you never miss an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday and you're not going to want to miss it. I'll be back next week with a brand new one for you guys. And until then, stay safe. Bye, guys.